Hi there, I'm James Dapachee, and this is Coffee and a Case Note. Team, today we are going to talk about a group. And what that group does is it operates a number of luxury car dealerships. And there are two groups we're going to talk about that comprise this group. There's one group we're going to loosely call the plaintiffs. And when we refer to that group, we're going to refer to some of the directors of the companies that comprise the group, and also some of the shareholders that comprise the shareholders in the companies that comprise the group. Right? Plaintiffs, they're the 48% interest group. That's all you need to know. Defendants, you might be interested to learn they are the 52% interest in a similar way. When we're referring to the defendants, we're referring sometimes in this discussion to them in their capacity as directors of the various companies in the group, and sometimes in them and their related entities' capacity as shareholders of some of the entities in the group. And what we have today is we have an application brought by the plaintiffs in respect of corporate oppression. And in order to get there, I'm going to need to give you some more background. So, as I said, we have this group that operates a number of luxury car dealerships, and the nature of that arrangement is that it is a franchise sort of arrangement. And so these are a number of Australian locations of an international luxury car brand, and the franchise is renewed year to year, and so the group operating the franchise make the money by selling the cars and getting the commissions and however a luxury car dealership franchise works. And interestingly enough, the group sort of kicked off decades and decades ago, but as time has passed, there's been increasing distrust and bitterness and real enmity between these groups that we might loosely refer to, as we said, as the plaintiffs and the defendants. So they're at a phase where the relationship is not in a good spot. What today's application is about the plaintiffs alleging that the defendants have a conflict of interest, and the defendants alleging that the plaintiffs have a conflict of interest in respect of a different set of facts, and the question of how are we going to go about pursuing a debt owed to the group. Now, hold on to your hats for some background of the litigation. In the past, let's say around about 10 years before the piece of litigation we're discussing, the defendants kicked off some litigation. And essentially the nature of that litigation was the defendants strategically trying to get a one-up on the plaintiffs to sort of edge them out of the group and for the defendants to take a dominant role. And what was found by the court is that in running that litigation, the defendants had breached their director's duties because there was a conflict of interest. They were essentially using the entities in the group, the companies in the group, to pursue their own ends rather than the ends of the companies in the group, if that makes sense. And so the court finds, breach of your director's duties because your duties to yourself and duties to the company were in conflict. And so a judgment debt arose. The defendants owed the group $19.8 million plus the legal costs of the entities in the group, right? The defendants, let's just recap that, commenced this suit that the court found was an improper sort of strategic suit to try to get a one-up on the plaintiffs. There was a conflict of interest. They lose. They owe $19.8 million plus the group's legal costs to the group. And so the question we're confronted with today is, how does the group go about enforcing this judgment against the defendants? And it's a challenging question. The plaintiffs have a suggestion. The plaintiffs say, hey, appoint just us to form a subcommittee. That subcommittee will go instruct independent lawyers, and with the help of those independent lawyers, we will go ahead and achieve full value on this debt for the group of companies, consistent with our duties, and in order to sort of recoup the position. The defendants said, no, we resist that, and I'll come to some of the reasons. We resist that, and we say that we ought to appoint an independent insolvency practitioner. So the sort of person who is sometimes appointed as a bankruptcy trustee or a liquidator or an administrator or a trustee of a statutory trust for the sale of land, so a person like that. They say, no, let's appoint an insolvency practitioner, an IP is what we ought to do. So we have these competing proposals about what's going to happen next with the judgment debt. And the heart of the corporate oppression claim today is that the defendants are proposing to appoint this IP, the defendants are majority shareholders, and the defendants have a casting vote. And what the plaintiffs say is that is unfairly prejudicial within the meaning of Section 232 of the Corporations Act, and so it's oppression, and so we should get an order stopping that and instead appointing us to run this subcommittee to go chase the judgment debt. So, the court is left to compare the two positions. There are a number of moving parts in relation to the facts here. Importantly, we have this, as I'm sure I mentioned earlier, deep distrust, deep enmity, deep sort of strategic disagreement and really the lack of any relationship of trust between our plaintiffs and our defendants. As the relationships sort of devolve and get worse, the plaintiff heads over to have a chat to the head franchisor, and the head franchisor is based overseas and has this chat with a representative of the plaintiffs. And what the plaintiff does is sort of sound out the head franchisor, hey, how would you feel if we bought out the defendants and so we became the holders of the franchise you've got in Australia? How would that be? So sort of sounding out those issues. And in addition to that, provided copies of the court documents that the defendants had filed as part of the proceedings that showed one of the directors was in fact insolvent. And so the plaintiff is off showing this stuff and making these suggestions to the head franchisor. And what the head franchisor says is like, oh, well, these 5-year franchise agreements that we've been sending out, we might have to revise that position. And they send out a proposed 1-year franchise agreement and then even flag it might go to a 3-month or 6-month sort of arrangement. Now, as you might imagine, the defendants are very critical of this conduct on the part of the plaintiffs. And they say, look, you are putting at risk the sale price of this entire group. It's gone from a very reliable 5-year refresh to now this, is it 1-year, 3-months, 6 months sort of uncertainty. And so you have breached your duties yourselves. You've engaged in a conflict. Facing a conflict of interest between your own interest and the interest of the group by having gone and approached the head franchisor in this way. Now, to get back to what today's case is all about, remember the plaintiffs are saying we should be in a subcommittee pursuing this $19.8 million judgment debt plus legal costs. And what the defendants are saying is, no, let's appoint an IP. The court finds, firstly, that it would be inappropriate for the plaintiffs to be appointed due to this deep enmity, this deep distrust, and also in addition, following the retracing of the facts where the plaintiff said, oh, I had my director's hat off and I had my sort of shareholder's future of the franchise hat on, and sort of not quite understanding the boundaries of where their duties lie, the court was satisfied that the plaintiffs sort of lacked the real character of independence on one view to be appropriate to be appointed to pursue this judgment debt. There's another issue that arises in cross-examination, I think at paragraph 57 of the judgment, where one of the directors of the plaintiffs, it's put to them, the barrister who's cross-examining them says, hey, if you were to be appointed to collect this judgment debt, can you say for certain that the negotiation of that debt with the defendants wouldn't get mixed up with your desire to negotiate a share sale from the defendants? Can you say with confidence that these two ideas, judgment debt and your desire to purchase the defendants' shares, wouldn't get mixed up? And the plaintiff representative there accepts in cross-examination that there's no guarantee those two issues won't get mixed up. So the court is satisfied that the plaintiffs are not appropriate to be appointed. We head over to the suggestion made by the defendants that an independent insolvency practitioner be appointed. And after working through the relevant reasoning and the submissions made by the defendants, the court finds that that would appear to be an appropriate course. And so the outcome is the plaintiff's oppression suit, saying, oh, appointing this insolvency practitioner would be unfairly prejudicial to us, that application fails. And it fails for some of the reasons I set out above, but also because it takes more to win an oppression suit than just to say, I'm a minority shareholder and I don't like what the company's doing, which is the way, speaking loosely, the court characterises the application. It takes actual evidence, actually convincing the court that the proposed conduct is unfairly prejudicial and the plaintiffs did not meet that mark. And so the court says the oppression claim has failed, and the court has every confidence, noting the 52% shareholding and the casting vote in the hands of the defendants, that it looks pretty likely that an insolvency practitioner is going to be appointed shortly after the handing down of this judgment. Hope that discussion assisted you, and I look forward to chatting again soon over another coffee and in respect of another case note. Cheers.